It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Tomorrow, this Saturday, the August Wilson Cultural Center is hosting AW Community Day. It focuses on the African-American experience and the late Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright August Wilson. The celebration includes a performance by Wally Jamal of Wilson's final play, his autobiographical work, How I Learned What I Learned. Wally Jamal, welcome to The Confluence.
Well, thank you for having me, Megan.
Wally, not many actors have performed in all 10 plays in August Wilson's American Century Cycle, one for each decade. And so far, you're the only actor to do all 10 and Wilson's one-man show. Do you ever think that you would do the whole cycle, let alone the cycle and the final play?
No, to tell you the truth, no. And I would say that neither did August. When he just started writing, and a lot of times that's how things happen. You just start doing, and then it names itself after you stop and look back and say, hey, look at that. You know, so that's how it went.
Your first August Wilson performance, that was Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, right?
Yes.
What struck you about that first show, or even the second or third, that you dedicate yourself over and over again and again to another August Wilson play?
During that play, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, it was being done on Broadway with Whoopi Goldberg and some other celebrities. Mm-hmm. And it, and August liked our production better. And he actually came to our production. He was in town attending the funeral of Rob Penny, formerly of Cantu Repertory. And I knew in my character, Toledo, died at the very last moments of the play.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, right. And the director, Eileen Morris, had this red special on me. And I knew exactly where August was sitting. And my character, it was in the script, my character had to die with his eyes open. So, knowing where August was sitting,
oh no,
I just stared right at him. And he had such a horrified look on his face that I was like, I got him. And when we had the curtain call, he came right to the stage and shook my hand.
Most of these performances have been part of scheduled presentations by theater groups. Is it extra special for you to perform August Wilson's autobiographical play at a community event celebrating Black Lives and August Wilson himself?
Oh, most definitely. One of the most significant things that I think there is with my performing of it is that I've done the plays and I've grown up in and out of the Hill District. I'm a Pittsburgher and I've sat and read one of August's plays with him. So it's very auspicious for me, and I think that I would bring more love and reverence to it than someone who is not quite as familiar with his work.
Did you know August Wilson well?
Not well, but I had the occasion of sitting there. We did a seated reading of Jitney, where he read with us, mm-hmm. Performing one of the roles, and he was fantastic. He was a beast. And you just didn't expect that from him, and it was amazing. And I actually got to talk to him. And we talked about fishing, but then I wrapped it up by the obvious, like, you got any advice for an up-and-coming playwright. And he said, mm-hmm. Write what you know, and what you don't know, research.
Does it ever feel, when you look back on moments like that, like you do know August after spending so much time immersed in his brain and his work and these characters that he created?
Oh, definitely. Especially when we did Ma Rainey and I had opportunity to talk to him, I said, this guy I'm playing, Toledo, he's you, isn't he? And he looked at me and he said, they're all me, even Ma Rainey.
Oh my gosh. So for these century plays, you're working with an ensemble. When you do the one-man show, the spotlight is always on you. That's kind of flattering, right, for a performer, but I assume it's also a little more demanding?
It's terrifying. It's demanding and terrifying. And the easier it looks from the audience perspective, it's the harder it is. And the thing is, before I got involved in theater, I did stand-up comedy around here in different clubs around the city.
That requires a lot of audience engagement, right?
Yes. And the longest set I ever did in front of an audience doing stand-up was about 45 minutes. And that kind of prepared me. The most demanding part of doing a 90-minute, 63-page, one-person show, to me, is keeping the audience awake. And you do that just by going back to the basics, storytelling 101. Imagine yourself telling a three-year-old a bedtime story about the three bears. You better believe you gotta be those three bears and Goldilocks. So when doing the show, you gotta be that character. Whether it be an old man at a nursing home or a little girl in seventh grade or what have you, you gotta be all those people.
And you feel that inside, you become them?
Yes. And August gives you those tools to build this character with. He lays it out for you. I mean, in the way he writes the dialogue, it speaks to me like my aunts, my uncles, my grandfather, my grandmother. And it allows it to flow out of me. I allow it to flow out of me instead of trying to control it.
When his characters, too, are so complex, they're never one dimension.
Right. And you know what they want. And that's the basic tool to engage an audience, because once the audience knows what that character wants, they can sit there and they can root for that character. Or they could say, they could boo that character. I don't want him to get what he wants. He wants to get with that girl and means her no good. But that's what gets the audience engaged.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, and our guest is actor Wally Jamal, who's performing August Wilson's last play Saturday as part of the August Wilson Cultural Center's AW Community Day celebration. For our listeners, the show How I Learned What I Learned, August Wilson tells stories, introduces us to characters, people he knew, and Wally, you have to be all of those all at once. In your earlier roles, you've taken on the persona of a character that August Wilson created. In that show, How I Learned What I Learned, you're presenting and portraying August Wilson himself. Is that exciting or daunting?
It is, and I have to say that I'm standing on the shoulders of actors far greater than myself, like Eugene Lee. I was able to see him perform the show a few years ago, which got him Performer of the Year. And I saw that you can't approach this trying to do an impression or an imitation of August Wilson. You got to tell the stories. And that in itself will give you the personification of August without trying to look exactly like August or talk exactly like August. Tell those stories like August would tell those stories.
When you're performing plays that have such a storied history from fellow actors who've done such remarkable jobs on stage, does it ever feel like a challenge to bring something of yourself, something a little different to the stage each time?
Oh, yes. And you have to, because you never stop working your script. I don't care if you've done the show 100 times, you still will go back into that script and see something that you glossed over the last time or something that you didn't fully understand. By the time you're doing your last show, you feel like you're just ready to open.
The August Wilson's Century Cycle plays are each set in a different decade in the 20th century. Why do you think they still resonate so well into the 21st century?
Oh, the August plays are, to me, simpatico with the ancient Greek tragedies. These are stories of the human experience, and there's certain aspects of the human experience that transcend time. There's just as much jealousy and hatred today as there's been in Greek times. It's human, and there's been hunger, there's been desire, there's been aggressiveness and ambition and obsession. And those are the things that transcend time that you can put into today's stuff ripped from the headlines and see the same tragedies playing out.
What do you expect from the performance on Saturday? Do a lot of young people show up? What kind of audience engagement do you get?
Well, I will say this, that there's a lot of adult language in the play, mm-hmm. and I would like for younger people to see it, but only those 17 and older.
Fair.
Because it's some of the subject matter is very adult and can be a little strong for young audiences. But that's...
It's harsh, right?
Yes.
It's a difficult reality.
Yes. August will... the way he lays that trail of breadcrumbs for you is he'll lay you down a road that's to laughter. And as soon as you're in the middle of that laughter, he punches you in the stomach. And that's how life does you. Life will make you think you got a you know, nice little piece of candy and it gets snatched off of you and you get pushed down or kicked in the leg.
Director Mark Suthers is staging his own take on the American century cycle. His new project is set in the 1800s, building on Wilson's work documenting the 20th century. I understand Mark has been something of a mentor to you. How important is it to you to keep building these connections artist to artist?
I tell you, I didn't know who August Wilson was. So it was Mark Suthers who introduced me to August Wilson, his work, and the man himself. And I could never... ever forget that.
And, in retrospect, that's really kind of life-changing.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely changed my life for the better because it was just a vehicle in which I could express myself artistically and in the way that I can communicate. Well, in all of August's plays, there are incidents, there are scenes where there is an older black man counseling a younger black man. And that's the most important thing that I take from all of his plays, the counseling and the admonishments and that sort of thing. And they exist. There is a gap between older black men and younger black men because of the way society is. And these plays can be a balm in a conduit that will connect them. And maybe there'll be less killing and less, you know, hatred and just turmoil in the black community.
Actor Wally Jamal is performing August Wilson's final play, the autobiographical How I Learned What I Learned, Saturday as part of the AW Community Day celebration at the August Wilson Center. Wally, good luck on stage, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Megan.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. 4 months after a hazardous and electronic waste program was supposed to begin, officials say it's being tied up by paperwork. The city announced last year it would offer residents home pickup for items like TVs and computers, as well as drop-off services. Officials now hope to start the program next month. And a popular hiking trail is closing over safety concerns. The Glen Innoko Falls Trail, located in Jim Thorpe, features picturesque waterfalls but has been the scene of many deaths and injuries over the years. State officials say it would cost nearly $2 million to add necessary safety improvements to keep it open. Find more online at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. Toy Derricotte is one of Pittsburgh's most revered poets, and her work is known nationally. Derricotte's latest book is out this month. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll has this profile.
Hi, how are you? Good to see you.
It's a Sunday night in April, and Toy Derricotte is greeting old friends at Alphabet City on the north side. Some 120 people have gathered to mark the release of Derricotte's book, I, New and Selected Poems. The collection spans her nearly half-century career. Derricotte turns 78 this month, and the audience ranges in age from their 20s to over 90. But she is especially appreciated by younger African-American poets, poets like Yona Harvey, who takes the podium to introduce Derricotte's reading.
I suppose I have to begin with Toy's truth-telling, because I am, like hundreds of other Black American poets, a huge benefactor of those truths, both on the page and in the world at large.
Many poets avoid identifying with the I in their poems, but Derricotte is known for her confessional approach. Here she reads from her poem, Speculations About I.
I was the closest I could get to the one I loved, who, I believe, was smothered in her playpen. Perhaps she gave birth to I before she died.
Derricotte was born in Detroit. Many of her poems confront her childhood relationship with her father, who frequently beat her. She has taught for 3 decades at the University of Pittsburgh, where she is now Professor Emerita. Her poems also often address race. Derricotte is a light-skinned African-American who is sometimes taken for white. In her poem, Passing, she describes a white woman who seems upset to learn that Derricotte is black.
Why presume passing is based on what I leave out and not what she fills in?
Derricotte emerged in the 1970s. Randall Horton, a poet and professor at the University of New Haven, says Black voices in American poetry were scarce back then, and those of Black women even scarcer.
She becomes hugely important, in that regard alone, for women of color to be able to sort of see themselves in their various selves.
Derricotte's legacy includes the Black poetry collective Cave Canem, which she and poet Cornelius Eady founded in 1996. The nonprofit group has provided workshops and networking for hundreds of Black poets. Horton, for instance, says Cave Canem was invaluable to him.
It's the idea of being able to be, for you to call me on the phone right now and talk about poetry. That's what Toy is.
Derricotte has a reputation for getting her students to cross difficult emotional terrain, and she does so in her own work. Her poem, Pantoum for the Broken, deals with sexual abuse. It ends like this.
I leapt from my body like a burning thing. Not wanting to go back, I make it happen. Until I hold the broken one, hold her, and sing.
Dawn Lundy Martin is a University of Pittsburgh professor, an award-winning poet, and a former student of Derricotte's. At the reading, she says she admires how Derricotte handles difficult material.
She's able to really take the image, make it so that you get in really, really close to it, and feel it in a way that, is both inviting and bodily.
Derricotte says early on, she struggled to tell stories like her experience giving birth in a home for unwed mothers back in the 1960s.
It was scary to be visible in my childhood. I'd get knocked down. And so I learned how to knock myself down before I put myself out there and became vulnerable.
Her work changed course with her 2011 collection, The Undertaker's Daughter.
The me was the voice underneath there, determined to live, to express itself. That was me.
Her new book, I, tracks her growth to the present.
Which feels a lot less like argument and more like, I don't know, just kind of being with myself and kind of a happy expression is the way I could put it.
She puts it this way to the audience at her reading.
I mean, that's why it's called I, because in every book, there's some aspect of myself that's getting kind of unburied.
I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Utility companies have an age problem. Across Pennsylvania, 28% of their workforce is expected to retire in the next 5 years. For State Impact Pennsylvania, 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk looks at how one power company hopes to replace those workers.
It's quiet in this classroom at Duquesne Light, the company that supplies electricity to most of Allegheny and Beaver counties.
I'm just kind of drawing like an A-frame house with a garage on the side and nice front porch.
Louis Charlier of Beaver Area High School is one of 10 students sketching their dream homes. He's hunched over drawing his from three angles, straight on, from the side, and a bird's eye view. This is a lesson on blueprints, something the students will become familiar with if they pursue careers with the electric power company. The teens have arranged their schedules to be here for a few hours each afternoon as part of Duquesne Light's new student boot camp.
They take classes around mathematics, reading comprehension.
Selena Gregg is with the company.
We're also doing soft skill classes on interview skills, resume writing, as well as an OSHA 10 class and a CPR class.
The power supplier will host a similar program for high school teachers this summer. Debbie Kilmeyer is with the Community College of Allegheny County, which is partnering with Duquesne Light to host the camps.
If teachers don't know about the positions or some of the technical things that are out there for their students, they're not able to talk to their students and share those experiences.
It was a teacher at Charlier's school who heard about the boot camp from a Duquesne Light employee and suggested he apply.
I don't really want to go to college because I don't really like school, how it's all set up and everything. I'd rather just go like straight into the workforce or like do a trade, something along those lines.
On day two of the camp, something Charlier heard from one of the company's executives caught his attention.
He told us that this job opportunity is going to be like having a $3 million lottery ticket.
$3 million. That's how much these students could expect to make over the course of their careers if they work in a skilled trade at Duquesne Light. As a line worker, for example, installing and repairing power lines, their starting salary would be $65,000 to $85,000, plus overtime. That sounds pretty good to Charlier.
There's plenty of jobs out there that pay really well and you don't need a four-year degree for, and these jobs are needed.
They're needed across Pennsylvania. Power companies from Duquesne Light to First Energy to PECO are active in recruiting new workers, running programs and internships to give prospective employees hands-on experience. The Public Utility Commission is working on this issue, too. Here's Chairman Gladys Brown.
The baby boomers are starting to retire.
The PUC last year launched a utility careers campaign to promote the industry to young people and to military veterans by talking up the positions at job fairs and other events. While the workforce shortage is a challenge, Brown says it's not dire. The PUC keeps close tabs on utilities' performance to ensure that outages don't become too frequent and that response times are reasonable.
You want to make sure that you have the appropriate skilled, trained personnel on hand to deal with providing that reliable service.
For Duquesne Light, that means keeping a steady stream of potential workers going through training. This boot camp is a first step. Students who complete it will take an exam, and if they're successful, they can move on to what's known as pole school. Here's Greg again.
I think a lot of people come in and they don't realize if they're scared of heights or if they're able to climb to the top of a pole and then be able to work with their hands.
The next step is a year-long program at the Community College of Allegheny County to learn the ins and outs of working for the electric distribution company. Charlier can't wait.
I did well in like all the practice exams, so I feel like I'm going to pass that test and I feel like I can climb a pole.
That can make him part of a new generation of workers tasked with keeping the lights on. Amy Sisk, 90.5 WESA News.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between WESA, WHYY, WITF, and the Allegheny Front, covering Pennsylvania's energy economy. I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. The prevalence of milk banks, those organizations that collect, test, and pasteurize human breast milk, has more than doubled in the U.S. over the last few years. And here in Pittsburgh, the Mid-Atlantic Mother's Milk Bank is pushing state lawmakers for more consistent industry regulation. Joining us to discuss all this is Denise O'Connor, the group's founder and executive director, Dr. Deborah Bogan, a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. She also serves as the Milk Bank's volunteer medical director, and Dr. Jen Clays, also at Pitt, professor of pediatrics, Milk Bank board member, neonatologist, and the medical director in the NICU at McGee Women's Hospital. Thanks so much to you all for making time for The Confluence.
Thank you.
Excited to be here. Thank you.
You as well.
So despite the expansion of milk banking in recent years, lots of people still don't know much about it, or sometimes that it exists at all. Denise, what exactly do milk banks do?
So what we do is we get milk from volunteer donors that are tested or screened, and then we test, bottle, and pasteurize the milk, and then it is used by prescription or hospital order. It goes to hospitals or to outpatients that have medical needs.
Who are these donors? Are they all mothers themselves?
Right. They're all mothers. They're volunteers. They're healthy lactating women who just generously give their milk. They have a supply that exceeds that of their own baby's needs.
Dr. Clays, why would you prescribe donor milk?
Well, certainly in the NICU, we know that breast milk in general is the best thing to feed the baby. Unfortunately, not all of our moms are able to either provide enough milk or to provide any milk at all, depending on any medications that they may be on or issues that they may be having themselves. So in that case, especially in our most premature babies, we rely on donor milk to give them the best nutrition possible and the best start possible.
What is that like for a new mother who maybe isn't able to produce milk or enough milk, or for other reasons decides she isn't interested in breastfeeding? Physically, mentally, how does that affect the new mom?
I think in general, they're relieved to hear that this is an option. It took us a little while to figure out how to explain it so that they would understand that it's very safe and it's pasteurized and we screen the donors and it's great milk and the best thing for their babies if they can't give us their own milk, of course. And then they realize that somebody has gone out of their way to donate this milk. Somebody else feels that it's so important that their baby receives milk that they're just glad that it's available to them.
So explain that process for us, how the milk gets from a donor to a recipient mom. Denise.
Sure. So the donors, they contact us. Oftentimes they hear about us from their own pediatricians, their obstetrician, their midwife, maybe at the hospital that they delivered at. They may have seen something, or from a breastfeeding class, they may have learned about us. And so they contact us and they go through their screening process. It's four parts. It starts with a phone interview. All of our screeners are nurses and or lactation consultants. And so we talk about things such as their medication use, their supplements, use, risks for bloodborne pathogens, travel, things like that. If that looks good, and after we complete that interview, that takes about 15 minutes, we send them an application packet with some more detailed questions, and then we send a little one-pager to the healthcare provider of the donor and the healthcare provider of the donor's baby, because we want to make sure that they're healthy, that their own baby is getting enough milk. And then when that's all done, we send them for blood work. Responsible for a very large area, so we serve Pennsylvania, West Virginia, parts of New Jersey, and also Maryland. And so we have convenient places for everyone to get their blood work. Now, if it's a local donor, once they're completely screened and they pass the testing, then they either drop off to us, our facilities in the Strip District. If they're not local, then they would ship it to us. And we have a very simple procedure for that, where FedEx comes to their door, or in some areas of Pennsylvania, we have depots. So we have several depots in Philadelphia where women can drop off as well.
Do hospitals prefer breast milk to formula?
Certainly for our tiny babies, we do. So we try to get all of our very low birth weight babies born less than about 3 pounds birth weight, on an exclusive human milk diet. So whether that's mom's milk or donor milk, we try to ensure that they get that.
What's the advantage, and how does that affect outcomes?
For us, we see so much better feeding tolerance. It's the perfectly designed nutrition for these babies. It's from another human instead of from another species, like a cow or something like that. So it's much different milk. It has all kinds of immunological properties in it that help the babies to fight off infection. We just see overall that they tolerate it better. And then there's a particular condition that our premature babies are susceptible to that affects their bowel, their gut. And we see much lower rates of that with the babies that receive donor milk or mom's own milk compared to babies that receive formula.
Dr. Bogan?
So before we started the milk bank a couple of years ago, none of our NICUs across the region were using donor milk. And because of the health benefits that we see in premature babies, all of the region's NICUs that take care of the extreme premature babies use it across the board. So it's really changed our milk bank presence here in Western Pennsylvania, has completely changed the practice of medicine in our NICUs across our region.
Across our state as well, because we started off with only 37% of the level 3 and level 4 NICUs. So those are the NICUs that take care of very, very ill babies. Across the state, we're using donor milk. And so now we're 100% in Western PA, and we're almost 100% in Pennsylvania as well. So
what has that been like, trying to expand the presence of the milk bank, but also just to raise awareness that this is a service that's out there and that it's a service that new mothers could contribute to if their supply allows?
Well, it's been chaos for 3 years because we're constantly growing, because as the facilities see what donor milk means, then means for their patients and the outcomes that they get, then we see each of the hospitals seem to be expanding use. We're now getting more outpatient orders. So we're constantly trying to meet that demand. So we're constantly trying to educate the public. Our goal is we want all families that are in the states that we serve to know that if you have more milk than you need, they know where, you know, who to contact. And if you're a family who may have, their baby has a need to be prescribed donor milk, we want families to know that it is safe and that it is a great thing for their baby. So we're constantly working towards that. So we do a lot of patient education materials that we have out at all the different facilities. We're constantly going to community events and to conferences for new parents and conferences for clinicians as well.
You said demand has increased. Is it the demand has increased, or is that milk is more readily available, so it's being asked for more often?
I think people are figuring out that it's out there, and they're hearing about it. So there is an increased demand, for sure. The availability is increased because there are more milk banks, but still, we cover a huge catchment area for our milk bank. And so before we were here, I don't think our region's patients knew that you could get outpatient donor milk. So it's one of being on shows like this that allow people to learn about what we do is wonderful.
Dr. Klaes? Even in the inpatient setting as well, we've seen just a tremendous expansion of the number of NICUs that either use donor milk or have a formal donor milk policy in place for all of their tiniest babies or the most fragile babies. It's really exploded. I mean, it's become standard of care in the NICU to be able to offer donor milk.
And mothers are demanding. So in the few NICUs in our region that in Pennsylvania that don't use donor milk, there are mothers demanding it, saying, I don't have enough milk for my baby. Why don't you use donor milk? And that has really driven hospitals to change their policies as well. So women are driving the change, well-informed women.
In working with those well-informed women, how is it affecting outcomes and maybe behavior patterns that you're noticing in these medical centers or mothers that are able to produce? Is it changing mindsets at all across the board?
Absolutely. And that's something that's been shown throughout all the literature looking at milk banks, is that once you get a milk bank policy in place, your own rates of breastfeeding, so moms providing their own milk, go up substantially. And we're seeing that even in our own NICUs here in Pennsylvania and in Pittsburgh in particular, with the milk bank so close by. It just becomes a whole focus of the unit that everybody's really tuned into breastfeeding and providing breast milk. So once you get everybody in that same mindset, it actually helps everybody.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're chatting with Drs. Jen Klaes and Deb Bogan of the Pitt School of Medicine and Denise O'Connor of the Mid-Atlantic Mothers Milk Bank. Denise, the milk bank here in Pittsburgh is supporting legislation, the Keystone Mothers Milk Bank Act, that would require milk banks be licensed according to national accrediting standards, set up prohibited practices, that sort of thing. Your group, the Mid-Atlantic Mothers Milk Bank, has been operating in some form since 2013, really in operation in 2016, and it follows guidelines set up by the Human Milk Banking Association of North America. So why is it so important to you to regulate milk banks now in a way that's different than you've been doing before?
Right. We choose to be part of the Human Milk Banking Association of North America because they have a 30-year history of having guidelines for screening and processing and ethical practices. But the reality is that there's really no regulation of milk banks across the country. So basically, we are considered to be food processing by the FDA, but that doesn't take into account things like ethical practices for donors, making sure that the processes that we do retain bioactivity. So lots of different considerations. It only really looks at bacteria and food spoilage, those types of regulations. And so we just want someone to be looking at it. So it's not that someone would have to be accredited by any particular organization. What the bill would do is that the Pennsylvania Department of Health would set up some minimal standards just to make sure that everything is done safely, any milk that is coming and going from Pennsylvania, because these are very, very fragile babies that are mostly using milk. And so there really does need to be some type of regulation.
So how would this bill or others like it that might come in the future affect milk sharing, so that private exchange of milk between mothers? Dr. Bogan?
So the legislation would have no effect on individual milk sharing between mothers. However, I caution women, there are a couple of studies looking at informal milk sharing, particularly purchasing milk from the internet, which I strongly discourage women from doing. There's differences between the old-fashioned, you know, your sister breastfed your baby or your cousin breastfed your baby. That's different. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about informal milk sharing. And this legislation has no impact on those practices.
From the medical perspective, what do you think doctors can do to raise awareness about milk banks and their benefits? Dr. Klaes?
Well, certainly we do a lot of education in the NICU with our local pediatricians, the doctors who are going to be getting our babies once they graduate from the NICU, to explain that the baby was on donor milk and what this has meant, and that now they've transitioned to hopefully mom's milk if her supply is increased or formula if need be, and why that worked so well. We also are working very closely with our obstetrical providers, trying to make sure that if women do have an extra supply of milk, that they think about donating it to the milk bank.
We're also working with our OB colleagues to really promote breastfeeding while women are pregnant, because we know that women make the decision about infant feeding often before they're pregnant or in their early stages of pregnancy. So by the time they come to the pediatric practice, it's late in making that decision. So the more women plan to breastfeed, the more likely they are to breastfeed and the more likely they are to breastfeed successfully. The other thing we really have to do in our community is provide really good support, because although breastfeeding is natural, it is not always easy. And so there's a growing community in Pittsburgh to really support women to breastfeed. Allegheny County has some really innovative initiatives going on right now. And again, I think as women get more comfortable themselves breastfeeding, the whole idea of donor milk becomes important for them as well. So again, general awareness about breastfeeding has to precede the awareness of donor milk.
And Denise, are there any future uses for breast milk that you're keeping your eye on?
Just expanding. A lot of hospitals are using it for all babies, regardless of gestational age, or whether or not they have some sort of complication or issue. So if mom maybe had a C-section and her milk is delayed a little bit coming in, and the baby needs some supplementation for a medical reason, to use donor milk as the first line of nutrition for that. So that's definitely evolving. And then more and more of the specialists seeing how we can really turn around babies who have exhausted all of their other feeding options and aren't doing well. You know, sometimes it even seems a little bit miraculous how sometimes babies get turned around. I mean, it should be expected, because, you know, of course human milk is going to be really tolerated. And so I see that evolution as well.
Doctors Jen Clays and Deborah Bogan are professors at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, and Denise O'Connor is the founder and executive director of the Mid-Atlantic Mothers Milk Bank. Thanks so much to you all for joining us on The Confluence.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris with a bit of a production note. Careful listeners of this program might have noticed that its usual host, Kevin Gavin, has been absent the last few Fridays. Many Pittsburghers, religious or not, have made fish fry dinner plans at their local church or fire hall this Lenten season, including at St. Catherine of Sweden Parish in Hampton. As fish fry season comes to a close this weekend, fellow Confluence producer and engineer Kylie Kaczynski and I decided to take WESA's listeners behind the scenes, where a familiar face and voice can be found manning the fryer at his seasonal side gig.
My first job was taking call-in orders, and the problem with that was the phone didn't ring. So I had to stare at the phone, and when it lit, I had to pick it up and say hello. Next position was working the line, filling orders, and I did that for many years, filling takeout orders. So they would take the slip, they would come to me, and I would either dole out the side orders or the fish. After that, about four years or maybe 5 years ago, Joanne, the head of the fish fry, said, "Kevin, I'd like to move you into the kitchen." And that's when Steve taught me how to fry the fish, and I've been there ever since.
Okay, the winning ticket number for the 50-50 is 250-921. It's a blue ticket.
My name is Joanne Giovannini, and I am the fish fry coordinator at St. Catherine of Sweden. Personally, I've been doing it for 5 years, but this is our 23rd year of doing a fish fry. It is our biggest fundraiser. It's a 6 weeks fundraiser, which is part of the reason why it's the biggest. We serve anywhere from 700 to 900 meals a week, and people are very generous. As far, we get lots of tips. The kids get tips. They turn them all in. We have a very good reputation for our fish fry.
How many pieces of fish would you say you fried today?
Today, a little slower. I would say about 500.
500 is slow.
Yeah, we can do up to 700. And we have done that a couple times during this Lenten season so far.
Kevin, he's like my right arm. Because it's a tough job. It really is. It's very, you're on your feet for four straight hours. It gets very hot. It can be very dangerous if you're, you know, splattering oil all over the place.
What is more work to you, hosting and working on the Confluence every day, or the fish fry on Friday? What's a harder shift?
The fish fry.
That's the host of this program, Kevin Gavin, at his seasonal side gig in Hampton. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, fatal opioid overdoses dropped sharply around Pittsburgh last year. But is it too soon to celebrate? FBI Special Agent in Charge Bob Jones talks about what went right, as well as what he's tracking from hate groups in our region. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kosinski, production assistants by Meg Fair, Mick Stinelli, Julia Zankovic, and Alex Lenigan. I am the editor and producer of The Confluence, Kevin Gavin. We'll be back with you on Monday and every subsequent Friday. I'm Megan Harris. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.